Welcome. It's 10 minutes past 1. It's House Judiciary Committee is in session. In attendance are Representative Holmes, Representative Samuels, Rep. Dahlstrom, myself, Jay Ramers, Representative Coghill, excused, our friends Rep. Gruenberg, Representative Lynn, for whom all of our collective prayers go out that, God willing, they should regain their health and rejoin us as soon as possible. Representative Gruenberg, who I reported earlier in the day would be joining us telephonically, is not yet up to that task, to my chagrin, because I was looking forward to more color
time.
Commentary in the committee, especially in the area in which he has so much expertise, which is crime bills. Today we are going to spend the entire session on House Bill 323. We have two crime bills from the governor that are going to be coming before us, House Bill 323 and House Bill 327. We will not move either of these bills until we have heard both of them thoroughly, they both are ambitious bills by the governor and her departments, and each of them caused me some initial concern pending a thorough vetting in this committee. So we are going to go very slowly on both of these to make sure that the rights of citizens are respected and that the rights of the members of the private sector are equally weighted along with public safety, which is a concern that we all share and none of us take lightly. So with that, I'm not sure who is going to present first, but we are mindful today that in addition to the folks that are in the room and every aspect of our legal system, we also have Lieutenant Dial with the state troopers who has a previous commitment. So after an initial presentation, we're going to go to Lieutenant Dial so that he can give us his presentation so that he can honor whatever time commitment that he has. So with that, who's going to present first for us, please?
Do you want me to move the bill?
Whether we need to or not. Already before us, right?
I have a CS.
I don't think there's a CS.
Okay.
It's already before us, I believe.
Okay.
Right? Wonderful. So we have 323 before us, so it doesn't need to be moved. And we have Mr. Sabodny, our good knowledgeable friend, and Annie Carbonetti. It's a pleasure to see you both and to have you both here in the Judiciary Committee. Welcome.
Thank you.
Yes, ma'am.
Chairman, my name is Rick Sabodny. I'm the Deputy Attorney General for the Criminal Division for the Department of Law. I'm here today to give you some introductory remarks about HB 323, which was introduced requested the governor dealing with crimes. Ms. Carbonetti, after I'm done, and Lieutenant Dials can go through the bill section by section with you, because you so aptly put it, she's a smart one.
No, I said you were, right? I gave you a lot of credit. We love her. We respect you.
We respect her, too.
But we respect her enormously, yeah.
It seems almost every year the governor, he or she comes forward to the legislature with some changes in the criminal laws of the state of Alaska. Sometimes those are creating new laws. Sometimes that's a change in how we do our sentencing system, and sometimes it's procedural matters. And oftentimes those are big, complicated areas of the law. This year we've chosen to do all three, but try to make it fairly discreet and not to try to make it very discreet so we can focus in on each event. So I want to talk about, just in general, the three areas that this bill covers. I'm going to put them in three categories. One, the creation of new crimes. That's really not totally accurate, and I'll describe that as I go through the procedural posture of cases or procedural changes that we are requesting, and finally, sentencing issues. This bill deals with what I would call three new crimes, but they aren't really new crimes at all. Section 4 of the bill deals with a change in the resisting arrest statute, which allows for circumstances where people are truly resisting, but they aren't fighting back. They are, as I think the Court of Appeals put it in finding that there wasn't a resisting arrest, the person turned turtle. They were being arrested, they laid on the floor, they put their arms and their feet underneath them, and they were just a lump that required four police officers to take the person away. So this bill deals with the situation where the police are trying to arrest somebody, and the person really is resisting that arrest, but not fighting back. The next area that really is a change in a substantive criminal law would be in the area of DWI. Probably read about some notable political figures in Washington, D.C., not in Alaska, who've gotten in trouble with driving under the influence of Ambien. Ambien and Soma. Those are not controlled substances in this state, but they do create a very public safety problem when people are driving under the influence. They have the same effect as somebody who's driving while under the influence of alcohol, and can cause equally the same damage. And then finally, in the area of new laws, is Section 11 and 18 of the bill. We aren't changing any of the laws that deal with fish and game. That's what those sections deal with. But it has become the trend with some judges in the state to have a new interpretation of our fish and game laws. In the past, I thought it was clearly the legislature's intent several years ago to make fish and game violations misdemeanors, some felonies, and some of those misdemeanor offenses could be reduced to violations. We oftentimes use that tool in fish and game cases, put somebody on probation for, give them a small fine, suspend, or a large fine, suspend some of that fine, put them on probation. Some judges have now decided that that's really not what the legislature meant, that if you are going to charge it as a violation, you can't be put on probation. You can't, the ill-gotten wildlife cannot be forfeited to the state. So this really puts us back where frankly, I thought we had been for 20 years, and allows the state to reduce a misdemeanor offense to a violation, and the person still can receive a suspended portion of the fine and be put on probation condition that they don't violate any fish and game laws. So I would characterize those three things as changes in the substantive law. We're also requesting some changes in the procedural law. And you will hear this afternoon from Mr. West about one of the cases that gave rise to the first procedural change that I want to talk about, and that is competency to stand trial. Competency to stand trial is a different, a lot of people think that we're talking about a mental disease or defect when we're talking about whether or not a person is competent to stand trial. That's not the case. A person is not competent to stand trial if they can't aid, they can't communicate with their lawyer, they can't aid in their own defense, they don't understand what the proceedings may be. And that may be caused by some mental illness or disease. It may also be that they are they're just not smart enough to know those things. It may be that they just choose not to know those things. So we have a procedure where if there's a question about whether somebody is competent to stand trial, they are evaluated by API. API makes a determination as to whether they're competent to stand trial. The problem is, there's a couple problems. If the person's not competent to stand trial, they still may be a danger to the community. You may have read recently in Anchorage about a 16-year-old who was charged with arson, found not competent to stand trial, released from API, committed another arson. Mr. West is going to tell you about a person very similarly situated in Ketchikan. I think there were seven. There may have been eight arsons that he committed, yet they're returned to the community. What this bill does is a couple things. It requires that the district attorney be notified that the person's going to be released back to the community. Hopefully that'll let us be able to contact the victims of the crime and let them know that the person's coming back. It also requires that an evaluation, that if a person is found not competent to stand trial, that a proceedings is filed to determine whether they're not whether they are present a danger to themselves or the community, whether they're committable under Title 47. Right now, that's not required to be done, and this would require that happen. It does not mean that the person is going to be committed. They may not be a danger to themselves or the community. And that will ultimately be for a court to determine, but it sets that, it requires that process be gone through. And then finally, in regards to the competency issue, is this, that right now, let me talk about the 16-year-old who was in the paper last couple weeks in the arson Anchorage. He was, I'm not talking about a juvenile case because he was waived to adult court where he was found not to be competent. But what happened in that case is he was released from API because, and not committed because he was not a danger to himself, an immediate danger to himself or an immediate danger to others. He signed a document saying, I promise not to commit arson. So that was the determination that he wasn't an immediate threat to the public. So this puts a process in place to hopefully protect the community. Two other procedural.
Can you explain
things.
That again?
Sure. Well, I'll try.
Yeah.
That's why you're fixing it. She's sitting next to me. She's good. No. What part about it?
You had an arsonist who signed a piece of paper that he wouldn't commit arson again, and so you decided he wasn't a threat?
Well, the issue for a commitment, which is a mental commitment, is different than whether you're competent to stand trial. What we're asking is, if you're found not competent to stand trial, that issue of whether you should be committed is looked at. Presently, the standard is whether you present an immediate danger to yourself or an immediate danger to others. Mm-hmm. And you can, dispute what immediate danger to others means, but in that particular example, the person said, I'm not going to go out and commit any more arsons. So API, using are you an immediate threat standard, made a determination that doesn't meet the legal standard. Now, I said API there. It may have been the court. I'm not sure it was API or the court that made that determination in that case. What this bill also does is it says that when the judge looks at that standard, he may or she may look at the underlying crime to aid in that decision as to whether you're in immediate danger. That means that, in the example, hopefully that will give the judge sufficient information to really make a knowing determination of whether you present a danger to the community. Quickly, because I know Lieutenant Dials needs to move on to be testifying, but the other two procedural changes deal with. One is, you may all know that under Alaska law, there's a bar to the state going forward with a criminal prosecution if the federal government beat us to the door of the courthouse. And that's not a that's a statutory provision. That doesn't deal with double, that's not double jeopardy that we're talking about, because we, the state of Alaska, is a separate sovereign than, from the federal government. The bill would take away that bar to criminal prosecutions, meaning the state could go forward with the criminal prosecution. And then finally, in the area of procedural law, we have some suggested changes dealing with search warrants. The problem has arisen with search warrants in this state. Most recently dealing with online enticement of children and child pornography. Law enforcement has requested search warrants to get information from Yahoo, from Google, from America Online, who are more than willing to give it to us, but they want to protect themselves. They want a piece of paper. They want a subpoena, and we really can't give them a subpoena because we don't have a case going on, or a search warrant. And some judges have concluded that they don't have jurisdiction to issue a search warrant for that type of document in another state. There's a legal argument that they do, but we never get to make that. They just deny us the search warrant. The bill would allow for the extraterritorial issuance of a search warrant that Google or Yahoo would honor, even though where they keep those records are in California or AOLs in Virginia. So it helps with the prosecution of those type of cases. We also are asking that the search warrant provision be changed to be equivalent to some of the other states and the federal government in allowing telephonic search warrants. We can get search warrants now by telephone, but they have to be, they require that the officer who's obtaining the warrant has to present evidence that without going through this telephonic proceedings, that it's likely that the evidence will be destroyed in that time frame. The time frame that if you could have got to the courthouse, you had enough time to get the warrant, that you couldn't meet that time requirement. This brings us into the 21st century. It recognizes the large territorial nature of the state. It saves money. This came to my attention when two Alaska State Troopers were at Devil's Elbow in the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta. They would have had to go by boat 8 hours to get a search warrant to be able to search a marijuana grow where they were at. They chose to use a cell phone, a satellite phone, get the search warrant, but we didn't meet requirements that the evidence could be was likely to be destroyed in the time it would have taken to get 8 hours down the river and 8 hours back up the river. So it's a cost savings, it's practical savings, it makes sense, and that we would be in conformance. We would be following the federal law in about, I don't know how many other states, but I looked at six other states this morning, including Oregon, California, Idaho. Turning to sentencing provisions, there are several sentencing provisions that go back to the decision in Blakely, which I'm sure you don't want to hear about, but they're kind of technical, and I'm going to leave it with Ms. Carpinetti to talk about that. One other big area in regards to sentencing is this bill.
Any other bill that we're going to get from the jail?
Would say that if you committed a third time or the third time an assault, and that third assault is a fourth degree assault, right now that's an A misdemeanor, that would be increased to a C felony offense. There are some limitations on that. First, how far do you look back to see whether you've committed these other assault, these crimes against people? This bill has a 10-year look back period. We decided 10 years was an appropriate period because if you had committed, say, a first degree assault and had 7 years, we still wanted to be able to get that person as having one offense if they then had another assault where they got a year, and then their third assault. I mean, somebody could be serving a substantial amount of time and eat up a 5-year or a 2-year or even a 10-year period of time if they've committed, you know, serious assaults as their first couple assaults. In addition, as you know, there are three ways of committing misdemeanor assaults. One of those is what I refer to as a fear assault, that by words or conduct place another person in fear of imminent physical injury. This bill would exclude that fear type of assault. I can talk to you about common law and what happened in England in 1840 about that, but I'll limit myself to Alaska. It was in 1978 when the legislature changed the criminal code. We used to have two separate crimes, assault and battery. Battery was the actual injury to a person, and assault was the fear. We've combined that and called them all assault 1, 2, 3 and fourth degree. We think that it's just a better public policy as we're doing this to eliminate the fear assault from the type of assault that could be increased to a felony if it was your third assault. I think that's a broad overview. I didn't go. I know that Lieutenant Dials needs to move on, and what we thought of is he would testify, and then either Mr. West or Ms. Carpinetti could go after that.
Okay. Is that all right with the members? Lieutenant Dial, are you with us?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I am online.
How much time do we have with you?
As much as you need, Mr. Chairman. I'll just go to the other one when I'm done.
Okay.
For the record, my name is Lieutenant Rodney Dial. I'm an Alaska State Trooper stationed in Ketchikan, Alaska. And I would just like to say that the department fully supports House Bill 323 with two areas of specific importance to the department. One is Section 4 involving the resisting arrest statutes, and Section 6 and 7 involving search warrants. Regarding the resisting arrest statute, as you've heard, currently law enforcement officers statewide face a situation on a somewhat frequent basis whereby we have an individual that's been informed that they are under arrest for an offense and they passively resist arrest. And by passively resisting, I basically mean the people that won't get out of a chair, that won't get off the floor, won't move when we're directed. And when we face those situations, it really forces the officer into a situation where they have to use a higher level of action to gain compliance and effect their arrest. And obviously, any time an officer uses that additional action or a higher level of force, the likelihood of injury increases dramatically for everybody. Currently, to prove that an individual has resisted arrest, we must show one element is that their actions create a substantial risk of physical injury to the person or to a person. And this bill basically just added a section of the statute which reads that if the individual disobeyed an order of the police officer, namely the officer telling him that they are under arrest, that they could be charged with resisting arrest. For us, and that's going to be most effective with our repeat offenders, those who have passively resisted in the past and have it would have the potential of encouraging them to comply in the future. And then to move on to Section 6 and 7 involving search warrants. As you can see, Section 6 deals with allowing the court to issue warrants to locations outside of the state. You heard why that was important for our investigations involving crimes involving technology, internet crimes, and those type of things. Another example would be the interactions that the state troopers have, for example, with the RCMP in Canada. We recently had a case here in Ketchikan where our troopers investigated a case in Hyder. An individual had a serious accident. He was drunk driving, seriously injured a number of people. And people who are injured generally in Hyder are transported to Stewart, Canada for treatment. So part of our investigation was to obtain the medical records for the individual who caused the accident to show his blood alcohol content. And in that case, we were able to find a local judge who was willing to issue us a warrant, which, and the Canadians are great, they will honor those warrants. However, there was no requirement that the judge do that. And, you know, we feel confident in saying that some of our judges would have not issued the warrant, and this bill would help ensure that, you know, if we are able to meet that probable cause requirement, that the judge would not refuse to issue the warrant solely because the evidence that we wish to seize is located in another jurisdiction. And then finally, Section 7, dealing with the telephonic search warrants. Once again, that's especially important for the Department of Public Safety and for the troopers who work in remote locations far away from the nearest courthouse. We've all experienced cases like the one that was mentioned by Mr. Sabodney, where we're spending significant amounts of time to travel to a court and to stand before a judge to provide essentially the same information that we can provide telephonically. And this is just something that, you know, we'll still have to meet those same standards. We'll still have to, you know, convince the judge that we have probable cause for the issuance of the search warrant. It just will allow us to get more of those telephonically, and it really is, we think, better for all involved. And then just once again, the department supports the bill, so I'll stand by to answer any questions that you may have. Thank you.
Representative Holmes?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm looking at Section 6, so we're on page, near the top of page 3. I'm just trying to get my head around. I understand why you'd want to be able to get a search warrant in another jurisdiction. I'm just curious about enforceability of search warrants across lines, and this may be partially a question for Lieutenant Dial and partially for our Department of Law, but I'm wondering, just because we issue one in another state, are there... You know, Lieutenant Dial, if you got a copy of a search warrant that was issued from Kansas saying that they wanted records, something in Alaska, would you honor that without something coming from the courts of Alaska?
Through the chair, Representative Holmes, if I received a request from another agency to assist in the execution of a search warrant that was issued in another jurisdiction, I would attempt to serve that. Let's say it was for phone records from our local utility. The local utility may object to that, and if they objected, then we would probably go through our local court systems to see if we could get additional information. However, we would, you know, if we had a search warrant issued in another jurisdiction, we would attempt to honor that here, at least on the trooper's level.
Yes, that, I mean, my main concern is, you know, are we putting something on the books that in the real world isn't going to be honored either by the courts or by the troopers, either in our state or another state. So I guess that's just kind of an ongoing question that I'm going to have, and whoever wants to address it.
Lieutenant Dial, I have a question for you, and I'm not that familiar with police procedure. But when, at what point when I'm issued a traffic citation am I being issued the citation? And having never been arrested, I've never been arrested. I don't know at which point an arrest begins and when disobeying an order of a peace officer would construe an arrest. For instance, you know, we have a very aggressive defense attorney for DUIs who advises, I mean, this just comes to mind, we have an aggressive attorney for DUIs in Fairbanks who instructs his clients or potential clients that when asked by a law enforcement officer to step outside to take a portable breathalyzer or to you know, recite his alphabet backwards or every third letter or the litany of sobriety tests, that he advises his potential clients to decline the offer to do that from law enforcement. But in fact, if that's the beginning of an arrest procedure, couldn't that be construed as as a resisting arrest for a failure to participate. At what? How do we determine the line at which you're being asked to do something and the line at which you are disobeying an order of a peace officer?
Mr. Chairman, from our standpoint, once we informed the individual that they were under arrest, at that point, refusal to comply would be considered resisting arrest, especially under this bill. In the case that you mentioned where we pull over a car, we suspect that the driver's intoxicated, he's refusing to get out of the car, he's refusing to comply with the field sobriety tests, we would, at that time, try to make a determination if we had additional evidence to support a charge of driving while intoxicated. I mean, we could go on other, you know, what do we see in the vehicle? What is his manner of speech, bloodshot, watery eyes, a whole litany of additional items. The mere refusal to participate in the field sobriety test would not preclude us from making arrest for something such as DUI. It may make it a little bit more difficult. However, if an individual refused and we had no other evidence to suggest that a crime had been committed at that point, we would, that most likely would be the end of it. It would go about their way.
I appreciate that. I think the question I'm getting to is, I'm not worried about, you know, a fine law enforcement official such as yourself. I'm thinking of the overzealous, you know, 6 months out of the academy law enforcement people. And at what point does an arrest begin? And I'm unclear on where that line is. And I'm reading the language in Section 4A. And I'm trying to get that. It says a person commits the crime of resisting or interfering with arrest if, knowing that a peace officer is making an arrest with the intent of preventing the officer from making the arrest, the person resists personal arrest or interferes with the arrest of another. So what if the passenger has a video camera and wants to videotape the process of the arrest? Is that person interfering with the arrest? At what point is the law enforcement official asking questions and probing and doing his duty, and at what point is he encroaching on the rights of that person before the arrest procedure has begun? I mean, there's no, the arresting officer at no point in time says, all right, I am now beginning the arrest procedure, therefore a second set of rules prevails, and I'm interested in where personal liberty ends and where the law enforcement arrest procedure begins. Is that a, I'm not a lawyer, so I'm, is that a good question? Representative Holmes, am I asking a good question?
Mr. Chairman, you're asking a question right along the lines of something that my staff and I were just discussing, so I think you're right, that and your part about it applying not only the person who's being arrested, but passers-by.
Mr. Chairman, I hope I'm understanding your question, but from my perspective and what we teach in the academy is that the arrest procedure starts once we inform the individual that they're under arrest. So up until that point, it's merely investigation. So from us, it's somewhat simplistic in that you're not under arrest until you're advised you're under arrest. And as far as the third-party involvement, if once that individual has been advised that they're under arrest and you have some outside influence and they're trying to prevent the arrest at that point or interfere with your ability to place the individual under arrest, then that's what we would consider the violation.
Okay, I get that. Annie, if you would help us after Lieutenant Dial departs to, or when we come back to this bill, to help us with some clarifying language so that that is explicit, because I understand what Lieutenant Dial is saying, but I don't interpret it that way, and I have a more broad construction in here when I read 4A and the new language in number 4. And so, Lieutenant Dial, from your point of view, if I was the passenger and I thought your behavior as the arresting officer was entirely inappropriate and I had a video camera or a cell phone camera and I was trying to take pictures, at what point would I be interfering with arrest? At the point at which you feel like I'm causing personal danger to the arresting officer, or, you know, at what point? I'll just stop there.
Mr. Chairman, that's somewhat hard for me to answer because there are so many potential variables. But for I believe the consensus would be from the average officer that if generally just the outside actions, the videotaping, those type of things, the yelling, the screaming, we do not consider that interference. It's the interference when somebody is moving their body in between ours and the individual we're trying to arrest. They're trying to allow a situation where that person could get away or something like that. It's more of a physical interference than it is anything else.
Lieutenant Dial, Representative Holmes has a question in a moment, but just so that you understand where I'm coming from, the common denominator that I'm trying to, the lens I'm trying to use to read this bill with the common denominator is not to frame, as you just said, the average officer. The concern I have is the below average officer or the newer member of law enforcement. And this comes up a lot in education when we talk about classrooms and people malign the public school system. They're certainly not maligning the upper third or even the median group of teachers. People that are being maligned are the bottom third. There's always a bottom third in any collective group, and that is who I take issue with is whoever represents the bottom third of any group.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I completely understand.
All right, Representative Samuels.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Lieutenant. I had the same exact questions for Ms. Carpini an hour ago when she was in my office walking me through the bill. So in the situation now, if the bill doesn't pass, let's say you come across, you see a drug deal happen or what you think a drug deal happened, and you yell, "Stop, I'm a cop," and people run away, including a kid who wasn't involved. He was standing there, you know, one guy was selling drugs to the other, and then a third party there, and everybody runs away. Under the law right now, would that be considered resisting arrest?
Through the chair, Representative Samuels, no, it would not.
Annie, do you have something you want to add?
No, I was just going to agree with Lieutenant Dial, no. As he said, the person has to be informed that they are under arrest before they are under arrest, and before at least this crime would be applicable to the crime.
Okay, and I think I agree with the chairman. I understand the point. I mean, if somebody, if you're getting four cops in there to just pull somebody's hands apart so you can put handcuffs on them, then everybody is in worse shape. And I understand that. But disobeying the order of a peace officer seems a little broad to me. No matter what paragraph A says, it just kind of sticks to me as a little bit overly broad.
I think the concern I have, just to distill it down into a layperson's terms, is if I were having coffee with a guy who was telling me an animated story, at what point in offering his narrative does he say, "Man, I got stopped by the cops last night," or does he say, "Man, I was going to get arrested last night"? At what point is it a stop, and at what point does the person believe that they were going to be arrested? And I need to understand that from a legal point of view, because I think that's the person that certainly is the fine point, the difference between being stopped and questioned and being arrested, and where does one end and where does the other begin, and how can we be more explicit in creating that bright line?
May I respond, Mr. Chairman?
Yes, sir.
Welcome to law school. The answer is, it depends. An arrest means something different under search and seizure law than it does for Miranda. Or for when you're taking somebody into custody. For purposes of this statute, an arrest is defined actually in Alaska law. 1225.050 talks about an arrest is made by an actual restraint of the person or the person surrendering to custody. So that's what we're talking about when we're talking about resisting arrest. When we're talking about is somebody under arrest for Miranda purposes, it's a different standard. That standard is, does a reasonable person under those circumstances feel they have a right to leave? So, and when we're talking about search and seizure law, it depends upon how long we're detaining them. So it wasn't, it's a difficult question that I think that if you talk to most civil lawyers, they wouldn't have they would be in the same position that you are, because we use that word in different contexts in the same case. I mean, somebody may be arrested for Miranda purposes at a different time in the event of a DWI arrest than they are for resisting arrest where they're actually restrained.
Mr. Subodny, would you please get out of the car? What's that? I mean, is that a request?
A request?
Is that an instruction, or am I on my way to being arrested?
It depends. Would a reasonable person under those circumstances think that they aren't going to be able to leave? Then the court would generally say, I think in your example, that's not an arrest. Now, it may be an arrest if you as the police officer have blocked my car in and I can't into a particular area. Well, not maybe. I mean, that's what the case law is. And I can't leave. Now, under those circumstances, if a reasonable person would think that that they can't leave, I'm arrested for Miranda purposes. It's not. I'm not arrested for resisting arrest purposes. The officer hasn't restrained me at that point. And just to go one step further, getting back to the common law, and this applies for Alaska, for the example that I think it was Representative Samuels gave of the people running away, that's not going to be a resisting, it's not going to be an arrest at all. It's not going to be an escape, even if the officer's yelling, you're under arrest, until we have this common law word, they touch them. Now, I know it's frustrating, but you have different answers. I mean, you use the word differently for escape or what we're using here, that is actual restraint, Miranda, and search and seizure.
Thank you very much. And Representative Samuels, but I'll remind you that we're trying to be mindful of the clock for Lieutenant Dial. So we have all the time, I assume, with you, Mr. Subodny, but we want to be respectful of Lieutenant Dial's time.
Okay, I've got one other question on this. So if in your example on the DWI or the potential DWI, if I'm driving down the street and the patrol car turns his lights on and his siren behind me, am I required to pull over?
You're asking me?
Or Lieutenant Dial, whoever.
Through the chair, Representative Samuels, yes, if an officer pulls behind you has probable cause to make a traffic stop and you do not stop, I mean, that would be a violation. You are required to pull over.
Yes, and Representative Dahlstrom.
Thank you, Lieutenant Dial. Nice to talk to you again. Just a follow-up on Representative Samuel's question. If I am a 16-year-old girl, 16-year-old young guy, female, an officer, someone I think is an officer is in a car that's decked out that looks like a police officer's car, and the lights go on, and I am one of the only two vehicles on the street, or the highway, or the wherever, and I keep proceeding until I'm in a lighted area and or somewhere where I feel safe, a parking lot. Is that going to be considered that I was non-cooperative, I was resisting, to me that would be common sense that I would do that, but maybe it goes back to the frame of mind of the officer that I would be dealing with, but is there a pat answer on that?
Through the chair, Representative Dahlstrom, in those cases, that's where we expect our officers to use some discretion. But we have all experienced the case where we do have those young folks who are in the middle of nowhere. I used to work in many low-light places like that. And if there is a valid reason, we would certainly consider that officer discretion. And then in those cases where Mr. Chairman mentioned, we have that one out of 100 officer who is not the good guy. That's where we would hope that case would be caught at the district attorney's office and dismissed. But I can tell you that at least the people I supervise, we apply a reasonable standard to those types of situations. The law does require that the individual pull over once they have a reasonable belief that a law enforcement officer is trying to conduct a traffic stop. There's always exceptions to the rule, and I guess that's the best way I could answer that.
All right, thank you.
All All right, Lieutenant Dial, next question I have for you is on Section 7, please. And I'm unfamiliar with the process of what is required when you go before a judge to ask for a search warrant and the manner in which that request is recorded. So my question is, does this bill give more power to police officers without judicial oversight if they are allowed to give sworn testimony telephonically? And will there be a record of the telephonic testimony?
Mr. Chairman,
I didn't write that question myself.
Our example is that, no, it doesn't give us any additional powers. It doesn't give us any additional leeway in the in acquiring a search warrant. All it does is it just makes it a little bit easier to present the evidence telephonically versus in person. We still have to meet a very high standard to get those search warrants. When we, and for the most part, our courts are pretty understanding of that, at least here in Southeast. When we have folks that, for example, are in north end of Prince of Wales Island, and it's midnight, and they're calling a court that may be, you know, several hours away, it's our impression that the courts will record that conversation one way or another, just as if we were testifying before them in the courthouse. And it's pretty much the same procedure. The only difference is that we're not there in person. They will even ask us on the phone to raise our right hand and put us under oath. So it's pretty much the same thing. It's just that we're allowed to do that on the scene versus before the magistrate or the judge.
Is there a witness to the telephone call on the, you know, when you're swearing, or can an officer do that from his patrol car, or you know, a VPSO, or I understand the point of this and I support it. I just want to better understand it.
Mr. Chairman, we do have to indicate verbally that we are swearing and that we have raised our hand. Other than that, there may or may not be a witness to the fact that we're doing that.
Okay. Rep. Samuels?
Thank you. And while we've got Lieutenant on there, and I see Mr. Wolliver from the court system, I'm curious about the procedures that would be in place. I too support, especially in a state like Alaska, I understand.
Absolutely.
You're out in rural Alaska, you don't want to have to leave, fly to the hub, get the search warrant, turn around, fly back. By then, you know, your case is blown. I understand that, but I would like to know, you know, what does a judge do now, and what would we do differently?
Through the chair, Representative Samuels, if you're asking me, I think what this is going to do is it's just going to change a few cases in which we are not able to satisfy to the court that a destruction of evidence will occur, and therefore they would prefer that we come before them personally. So I don't really see any changes as far as meeting the same standards. We still provide the individual at the scene with a copy of a search warrant. In fact, we fill it out right there on the phone while we're talking to the judge. We do hand him a copy of that. We also will file a copy of that at the court at the first available point in the investigation, and once we have the document signed by the court, we'll actually return back out and we'll give that to the individual along with an inventory of the items that were seized.
Okay, I understand from that side. I'd like to hear from the other side exactly how when the phone rings at the judge's house, middle of the night. I don't understand how it works.
I see Mr. Wolliver, if you'll introduce yourself for the record and are we doing okay for time, Lieutenant Dow?
Mr. Chairman, I consider this extremely important to the department, so I will just stay online as long as I'm needed, and if I do have extra time, I will go to the other one.
We are always mindful of your service and the value of your time to the whole Department of Public Safety, so you give us the high sign, and we'll let you go and then come back to this in addition, but thank you very much.
My name is Doug Wolliver. I'm the administrative attorney for the Alaska court system. Through the chair, Representative Samuels. The courts already can do this. We already accept telephonic search warrants. In fact, this statute was adopted at the request of the Supreme Court several years ago to handle just this issue. At that time, the legislature wanted to put in some restrictions on when those search warrants can be issued. But from the court's perspective, the procedure is essentially the same. The person calls the judge. They typically go on the record. The person is sworn in. They receive the information the law requires them to receive. They have to make the findings the law requires them to make. And but it's all done over the telephone as opposed to in person. But this is currently done and has been done. I can't remember now how long ago we had this bill passed, 6 or 8 years ago probably. And so what this section does is removes the current restrictions, but doesn't create any new procedures.
I'll defer to the majority leader.
Follow up, Mr. Chairman.
Right, sir.
Good. So you would no longer have to show that evidence might be destroyed. You can say, I'm here in Yakchak up the river. I'd have to get to Bethel. I know the judge is out of town. I'd have to find a fax machine. So now you what you're saying is the best way possible, but you don't have any delay. Does this happen at all in Anchorage or Fairbanks or the Valley or the road system?
Through the chair, Representative Samuels, actually the scenario that the troopers testified to at the time this bill was originally passed was a Valley case where they've got a trooper posted outside of a drug house. They're ready to go in. They're afraid the people are going to they may or may not destroy something, but they don't want to leave. And so under the old law, they would have to either wait for another trooper to come up to Willow to position himself or herself while the other trooper drove all the way into Anchorage, which was the only place you'd get the search warrant in the middle of the night. And so it's actually, although it's talked about a lot as a very rural exception, it was actually in some Anchorage cases that prompted.
Okay. Thank you.
Interesting.
Mr. Chairman, it's Lieutenant Dial. I just was advised that I need to leave. So if that's okay, I'm going to go ahead and disconnect now.
All right. Thank you, Lieutenant Dial.
Thank you.
Representative Holm.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So this rewrite here of the statute would pretty much remove any of the sort of sidebars on when you could use this procedure. You could basically use it for any search warrant at any time. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Holmes, that's how I would read this. One of the and I should always say, as I typically do but forgot, the court doesn't take a position on this provision or any other in this bill. I'm just trying to answer the questions. But okay. Yeah, I would see that you technically could call in from across the street. But I don't know that you would want to do that. I think police officers believe the same thing that judges believe, is you're more persuasive in person than over the phone. And but I don't see any restrictions here when that could be used.
Certainly not the contention of Junoites in legislative matters.
Very briefly, it was Mr. Wolver was going exactly sort of where I was headed anyway, which is a question: would we expect that at this point people would just stop showing up in court because you can just pick up the phone instead? And if that would be the A, do we think that would be the case? And B, if it was, do we care? Is that a problem? Is that a question for you or anybody else who wants to weigh in?
To the chair, Representative Holmes, I think in general judges prefer to have people before them. A disconnected voice over the intercom is difficult to assess credibility and things like that when you can't see the person. That's, we don't do arraignments that way typically. Typically, we have video conferencing and things like that, so you can at least see the person. If you can't see the person, it is more difficult to make credibility determinations. But we do these now, and I'm not aware of problems that have cropped.
Why is the standard different for the judiciary branch than it is for the legislative branch? I mean, we invite testimony, telephonic testimony, and a video testimony all the time. I mean, it is ardently defended. What's the difference between the two branches?
Mr. Chairman, actually, the court system relies enormously on telephonic testimony in all kinds of proceedings. But in general, if the person is across the street, better for the process for the person to be there. But we do a probably more so than any other state, we rely on telephonic testimony in court.
Thank you. Good answer. Thank you. Representative Samuels.
Thank you. Slightly off the point, but when citizens ask me how to access it, I always advise them it's better to be sitting in that chair than sitting on that telephone.
Exactly.
Always.
Right. It's true. It's true.
You'll find me more persuasive here right now.
Sure. You won me over.
You never have an opinion, though. That's the problem.
He's biting his tongue.
That he can say out loud.
Mm-hmm.
All right, I have more questions. Does anybody else have more questions?
You're doing great.
Mr. Sabodny, sections 9, 10, 11. Are there due process issues if the court can recommit an incompetent defendant for 90 days without a civil competency hearing?
Well, if they are, they've been there since this law has been in effect. I mean, that's what goes on now. That if there's a competency, they're under arrest. These people have been arrested. Bail's been set. 80% of these hearings these proceedings actually go on in the jail. They aren't moved to API. Sorry, that was a long answer. The answer is no.
Are people across the state remanded to API? Or I mean, is that our only holding facility of that ilk? And the reason that I ask is because we have some acute problems with the Division of Behavioral Health, and there's some other bill floating around that is treatment plus housing, and we have had a lot of our housing funds cut in the interior, which are subjecting mentally ill and some people that are responsible for self-medicating to go afoul of the law because they've lost the foster homes and the safe houses that they were otherwise in. Are they automatic? Is API the only facility that they can be remanded to? Or,
well, Mr. Chairman, actually, they're remanded to the custody of the Commissioner of Corrections. They're in jail.
Okay.
They're generally around the state, brought to Anchorage, and generally the reason that we use API just kind of as a shorthand is that it's the staff at API goes to the jail and does the tests and the interviews with the people. Now, that's not always the case. Sometimes they have a 10-bed facility where they move some of those people from the jail to API to make that determination. And frankly, I don't know how they pick who are going to be in those beds for that competency evaluation. Technically, it can be done in other locations. If there were the qualified people to do the competency hearing is in those locations, and technically they don't have to be in custody. The court could release them on their own recognizance, but then API has a terrible time because they can't find the people in Anchorage. We're saying that they're not competent to stand trial, and then they're left to fend for themselves in Anchorage. So the practical answer is yes, API is where everybody goes.
Thank you. Representative Samuels.
Thank you. I had a question on Section 17, the governor delegation of the extradition responsibilities. Maybe if you could walk through the extradition responsibilities.
I was thinking that it was Ms. Carpinetti's time to come up here, but I think I will handle that one since I'm the person who deals with extraditions and the governor. Extradition is the only right in the Constitution that's been given the states. The Constitution, the U.S. Constitution, allows the governor of one state to request to have the governor of another state issue a warrant to return the person to, if they committed a crime in Alaska. In this particular instance, it is my belief that our governor is probably the only governor in the nation who are really signing these extraditions personally. When I checked around, I couldn't find anybody, any other governor that was really doing that. They just do it. But because it's a constitutional provision that is one governor asking another governor, frankly, it's me personally who felt more comfortable in writing it into law. Oregon, this language is patterned after the state of Oregon, and there are apparently a couple states who have it done by statutes. Others are just doing it. And it seemed to me, because it was a U.S. constitutional provision that is a right to the state, that it was better to do it formally and to have a procedure as to who it was delegated to than just do what some of the other states do.
So, So do you think that a person on the governor's staff, some qualifications, could a governor, cabinet member or chief of staff, I can see the attorney general or either one of you, but that's not what it says.
Well, what happens here is I review every extradition that goes to the governor and send her a written memorandum saying, I think this meets all the qualifications, or I think that it does not. I like to, since I don't know of any time that she's disagreed with me, I like to believe she accepts my opinion. I think she would just, when she's, would like to be able to delegate this responsibility to somebody on her staff. And that person would be identified, and knows, and that information would be kept by the lieutenant governor. And I think, frankly, that's a whole lot better safeguards than, I'm not going to name any other state, but other states that don't set the system up and they just use a signing machine. Some secretary uses a signing machine.
Thank you.
I have some questions on Section 11 and 18, please. My first question on Section 18 is an unusual one, and if you don't have the answer, I'll understand. When was the last time that the schedule was updated for the penalty for taking all these different species of animals?
Dr. Nettie's going to get that for you.
Okay. And so while we're looking at that, on Section 1118, they appear to be directed toward fishing game. What issues brought on these changes for Section 11 and Section 18? 11.
I will.
Not sure if 11 is directed toward fish and game. Would you say?
11 and 18. Mr. Chairman, this is a pet peeve of mine. Glad you asked the question.
Okay.
I mean, we haven't had the ability to litigate this question in front of the judges.
Sorry.
Because at a training for the magistrate, one judge just said it's so, and so now all the magistrates are saying can't do it.
Can't do what?
You can't impose you can't impose probation, or you can't forfeit the game on using a monetary amount. So we've never been able to litigate that. They just decided it. Well, not they decided. A training judge for the magistrates told them what he thought the law was, and now magistrates aren't accepting plea agreements where it's a fish and game case where we've reduced it to a violation if we've included probation, if we've included paying a fine in lieu of restitution for the game.
Sorry, sometimes I need you to repeat yourself so I get it, because I don't get it.
The issue is that magistrates now, in the past, last year, our fish and wildlife prosecutors would, if somebody did something wrong, violated our statutes, could be a misdemeanor, and they would say, look, plead to a violation, so it's not a crime. $500 fine, $250 suspended, and $100 for whatever piece of game came to $100. On probation for 2 years on condition that you don't have any fish and wildlife, fish and game violations. That's how the vast majority of those cases were handled. At a magistrate's training conference last year, a judge told them that's not the law. You can't put somebody on probation for a game violation. You cannot have a monetary amount for the forfeiture of the game. And so we really haven't been able to ever litigate that because we don't get to appeal. And so the law's kind of, you know, so we don't get to say, you know, you guys are wrong. And you just hit a pet peeve. But that you ask why it came up. The judges have made the determination that what we've done for the last, the magistrates have made a determination that what we've done for the last 20 years wasn't following the law. And so we're saying, okay, well, here's our fix. We're going to make it clear that you can, for a violation, put people on probation, that you can have the game forfeit to the state of Alaska.
Okay. Annie?
I would just say that I think I would give the rationale why that decision was made by, or I'm not familiar with how it happened, but our probation statute does refer to the term crime. And technically, a crime is not included violation in Title 11. This is in Title 12, so I think that was what the misunderstanding
16.
Was. Title 16. This is Title 16. So we just wanted to make it clear that for those cases that there is a good resolution for the defendant or for the state, that there's a violation of probation, that the statute defining probation recognizes that you can do that for a violation in addition to a crime.
That answer is relevant to Section 11, is that right?
Correct.
Okay. And how about the schedule of fees set out in Section 18? And are those the same fees for a resident or a non-resident who takes, you know, we just had a fascinating meeting last night on precisely this subject. Looks like pretty cheap takings for
non-residents.
For non-residents for a very valuable Alaskan resource. So I have questions about Section 18.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I am unable to tell by the statutes when these amounts were enacted. I would have to go back to the law library and look at the actual session laws, but I will be happy to do that.
Okay, and is this the same schedule for residents and non-residents? Because tags are different for residents and non-residents, and would we be able to prescribe different penalties for residents and non-residents for the taking of game?
Mr. Chairman, I would have to find out. I would assume that they're the same, but I don't know that for sure.
Okay.
Find out.
Would it be legal? It's legal to have resident and non-resident fees for hunting licenses, fishing licenses, different kind of tags for different kind of animals. Could you prescribe a different penalty for residents and non-residents, or does that violate anybody's rights?
I hope so. Mr. Chairman, I'm sure it's been upheld that you can charge different fees for licenses, but the question of whether or not you could impose different penalties is something that's a little harder to answer on the fly, and that would be something else.
Okay.
You know,
there
is equal protection, and there are legal considerations.
Okay, I'd be curious about that, but I do understand that answer. Representative Samuel?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is just the restitution schedule, and this is also not, there's also fines that can be associated, is that true?
That's correct.
So this is just a different way of fining people, the restitution. And we're not changing that. I understand that. We're not changing any of that. But I just want to make sure I understand how the law works.
Yes, it's restitution to the state.
Restitution to the state, which would be different than a fine for an action. So when if you're going to research the question on is the restitution schedule the same for residents and non-residents, is the fine schedule the same or different also for residents and non-residents? And I'd be really curious. The question I was really going to ask was, how old are these numbers? If you can look that up, that'd be great.
I'll be happy to.
Thanks.
And I'll look up both the fines and restitution.
Yeah. You know, just speaking for myself, I feel like a maturing legislator when I'm asking questions that you want to ask and you're telling me just to keep going. I feel a lot a lot better. What offenses beside fish and game have fine and imprisonment? Not sure if I understand that note.
Violation.
I'm going to come back to that question because I don't understand the nature of the question. Are there other questions? I have a couple more. Are there any other questions from committee members? Will you? Oh, go ahead, Representative.
I just want to get to section 21. Is the other question I had when Representative came to my office. So if we had a, and I'd use the example of a drug dealer in Anchorage in section 21 that we wanted the feds to go get because their penalties are tougher, or they different evidence rules for whatever reason, you know, if he was convicted in federal court of a drug offense, he got 5 years, can we use the fact that he was convicted in federal court as evidence in a state court case?
No, you can't, through the chair. You can't use the conviction as evidence of the bad act itself. You could use it to...
So you couldn't say in his residence is...
No, unfortunately. Sometimes we'd like to, but we can't.
Okay, so, but, and also could you, if this passed, if you chose to, let's say the same drug dealer, he got 5 years in a federal court, can you, if this law passed, convict him under a state crime and postpone the sentencing and give him another 5 years, if you so chose to do that?
Through the chair, Representative Samuels, again, the answer is yes and no. We can convict him. He can be sentenced. Our appellate courts, where it's gone the other way, we've been gone first, and then the federal government's gone second. They've come back and said, well, you know, we have to look at what the federal government gave, and we can't end up having a greater sentence overall than we would have given at the outset. So, you know, when you say 5 years and it's a drug case, if we were talking a year and both the state and the federal government gave him a year, he could end up with 2 years. But there would be a prohibition on giving really extended sentences. Our courts would look at what they got in federal court and not give a greater sentence than could be given under Alaska law.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions?
Okay, I can follow up on that one. An example of when that would be used, and I guess the example was in you know, corporate violations that you had talked to before, you know, clean water standards and things like that. I mean, how would you anticipate this? If you can't, I understand if you could use the fact that he's living in Leavenworth as evidence now in your case. I kind of understand how you would want to do that. But give me an example of something that you would be allowed and you would want to do it. If you're not allowed to double on the sentence, if your goal was this is a really, really bad person and you finally caught him doing one thing, but you want tougher sentence than either you're allowed or the feds are allowed, I understand why you'd want to do that. But if you can't do that and you can't use the federal conviction as evidence in the state courthouse, if it's not double jeopardy, it sure sounds like it's getting close. When would you give me an example of when you'd want to do this?
A notorious example from outside of the state of Alaska was Rodney King. I mean, if the federal government prosecuted somebody and they were acquitted, we might really want to do it then.
Yeah. Oh, prosecuted, okay.
Through the chair, Madam Chairman.
I get it. Okay. I understand, I'll shut up now.
Okay.
There are also the question of fines for environmental acts, crimes, too, that I think could be imposed.
And does the federal law work where if we went first, they could follow along after us, and do they have the same restrictions then, where if we gave the drug dealer 5 years, he serves three, the day he gets out on parole, he walks into the federal courthouse, gets convicted, gets 5 years on top of ours. How does their system work?
The federal, through the chair, Representative Samuels, the federal government doesn't have the statutory bar like we do, so they could come in and charge. In regards to how the federal sentencing works, I don't know. I didn't want to mislead you. I mean, it may well be that in a particular case, somebody could get more time, and maybe even substantial more time. If there was a subsequent state prosecution, but our courts would look at what the person got in federal court, and use that kind of as a base for their sentence.
Okay, thank you.
All right, and thank you. I think earlier the question that Representative Ramirez was trying to understand was, we've been talking and dwelling on fish and game offenses. Are there other offenses not pertaining to fish and game that are punishable by both fines and imprisonment that would fall under and be covered under this new Section 11?
Well, Madam Chairman, I'm still not sure that I have the question, but are you saying, if the question is, are there other violations where we would want to drop a case from a misdemeanor to a violation? I don't think there are any. If you're asking what are the other violations, I don't remember where the legislature is now, but it's gone back and forth a couple times on littering, whether it's a violation or a misdemeanor, and I don't know where we're at right now, and that's really the only other violation.
Oh, I know one. Mr. Chairman, Madam Chairman.
Representative Coghill.
Yeah, we had an offense put on the books a couple years ago on if you didn't have a CO2 detector in your house, it was an offense.
Yeah, and we've thought of another here, the second minor consuming.
Okay, so.
And through the chair, actually, minor consuming is a violation, but it also allows probation. The statute specifically allows probation for minors who are found guilty of the violation, first or second offense.
And there could be a fine attached with that also.
I don't believe the statute, does it give a fine?
For minor consuming, Madam Chairman, there is a mandatory fine, actually, for the first and the second violation.
Okay, so maybe when you're going back and researching those, the fines when they were updated and those other things, if you could look into that area a little bit, just help us understand so we are sure what we're voting on. And I'm going to turn the gavel back over to the chairman.
Thank you. How about Section 10? Can you talk to me a little bit about just what Section 10 is? The defendant found to be incompetent to proceed under this section is rebuttably presumed to be mentally ill. What is the phrase rebuttably presumed? Who would offer the rebuttal testimony that this person is not mentally ill? You know, I just as an aside, I got in a lot of trouble this summer because of testimony we had from the Commissioner of Corrections, where he argued to this committee, I think, that in fact the Department of Corrections was becoming the de facto warehouse for the mentally ill. And when I repeated that to some advocates for prevention of mental illness, they took great issue with me in the letters to the editor in the Fairbanks paper. And then we had this problem this fall with funding cuts, as I stated, for housing and safe places for those that were responsible for self-medicating or to be in a group home. And so I'm very, have a unique sensitivity to how we are caring for those that are mentally ill or and what phrase like rebuttably presumed to be mentally ill, and who would be their advocate?
A rebuttable presumption is an evidentiary presumption that you start when a judge starts looking at the evidence that is presented. A rebuttable presumption is something that the court, the fact finder, takes into account and weighs in favor of that wherever the presumption is directed you to go. For example, under current law, a defendant is rebuttably presumed, although our law doesn't say rebuttable, but it doesn't have to. A defendant is presumed to be competent when the court is deciding whether or not they're competent to be tried. If they are found to be incompetent, that means that the presumption has, there has been enough evidence to overcome the presumption, then they are found to be incompetent. And at that point, the incompetent person is rebuttably presumed to be also civilly committable under our Title 47. That does not mean that evidence can't be produced by the individual or whoever else on the other side that could weigh the scale back in opposition to the presumption. But you start with that evidentiary presumption that a person who has been found to be incompetent to be tried for a crime is mentally ill and under the civil procedure, commitment procedure.
Doing Miss Representative Gruenberg right now. He would be awesome right at this moment. He would be so on his game right this second. Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Cochran.
I am certainly not going to be a Gruenberg, but I can understand when you come before a court, you're either this or that, and I understand that. But the that here is mentally ill and present a likelihood of serious harm. So I think that's a significant shift in policy. And so based on what I think it's a significant shift in policy, tell me what's different from what we do now to what we do when we put this new subsection in.
I'm sorry. Well, I guess I, through the chair, would disagree with the fact that, with your assertion that this is a substantial change in our law. This presumption arises after a court has found that this person is incompetent to be tried. And that is a very, I believe under our statutes, that you have to be severely impaired to be found to be incompetent to be tried. So it's not just a person without any history in terms of the justice system. This is a person who the judge has just adjudicated or found to be incompetent to be tried for the crime that he or she is charged with having committed. And at that point, when you are considering civil commitment procedures, you start out with the presumption that, you know, sort of giving some weight to that prior conclusion that in the next step, what we do with this individual after they, because they are too impaired to be tried, that they are presumed, therefore, to be mentally ill or a danger to themselves or to others. That doesn't mean that they can't come up and say, no, I'm not, or there are good reasons, there's evidence that I am not, but you start out with that evidentiary presumption.
Well, I got to tell you, I guess personal experience here gives me some caution because of a friend who had an incident where, having been knocked on the head, became unmanageable, did an assault, got before a judge. They deemed him mentally incompetent, put him in a psychiatric ward, and it became nightmarish after that. And the injury withdrew, but that label did not. And he was misused both with drugs and in time and his individual liberty. So, I mean, it's a big deal once you start going down that road. And I've actually seen it happen under the existing law. So I guess maybe my own personal experience makes me look at this a little differently. But I did not understand that the determination already being made had a significant hurdle. And I guess I need to understand that hurdle a little better. To actually then make a policy statement that they are presumed to be mentally ill, and then I'm going to try to find out what do we mean by mentally ill from there on. Under this code, under Title 12. So how do I get to that determination of a definition of mentally ill now that we're going to presume them to be after being mentally incompetent?
Incompetent
to proceed.
The statute provides, where the bill provides that if a person has been found to be incompetent to be tried for the crime that they're charged with committing, then they are referred to API, well, let's just use API because it's easier to say that. It's the Commissioner of Health and Social Services. And they are evaluated, and they're evaluated to see whether or not they should be civilly committed, and that would be the procedure that we would go under Title 47 for civil commitment procedures. And this evidentiary presumption would apply in that procedure.
I'll do some studying on this. Thank you.
Representative Holmes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As we're all trying to channel our good friend, Representative Grunberg, I'll jump in our collective effort to make him proud. I'm sharing some of the concerns that are being voiced here about, you know, shifting a burden is what we're doing. Instead of the state having to prove that the person's mentally ill and in danger, the person who is in that position has to prove that he or she is not. And this is somebody who we've already determined is not competent to stand trial in the first place, so probably not the person who's most up for their own defense. So, you know, I, just like Representative Coghill, I have to think a little bit more about the comfort, you know, who's going to be defending these people. Just because they were found incompetent, does that also mean they're dangerous? I guess I have to get my head around that a little bit. But the second sentence of Section E, Section 10, subsection E, says that the court's allowed to consider the conduct that the defendant was charged with. The person hasn't been convicted of anything yet. So I guess I also have to get my head around a little bit around the idea of using something that a crime that's been charged but not tried or convicted, and the extent to which I'm comfortable. If you could, you know, elaborate a little bit more on that section.
Sure. Well, and maybe Mr. Sobotny could too, but I think that the arson prosecution in Anchorage is a perfect example where you have somebody who started fires and found incompetent, who was then committed to API for evaluation and treatment. At a certain point when they're evaluating whether that person should remain committed in API, the standard procedure now is look at how they're acting today in the facility or in whatever arena that they are in under the medication that they are being given. Generally, they don't look to what happened before that because that was 6 months ago or 9 days before. And if the person is willing to say that, promise not to start fires again or commit crimes, and they're acting on a rational basis now, they don't look to prior behavior. And we think that it is reasonable when public safety is involved, when you're considering letting out a person who has started house fires, to look at what they've done in the past in addition to everything else when they're evaluating whether or not he or she is a danger to the public.
I have an interesting question for you. House Bill 327 presumably is going to come before us. And I'm reading here in sections 1 or 2 because I was reading I assume it's the equivalent of a sponsor statement from Attorney General Kohlberg. And he talks about including a provision that would raise the consequences for bullies who repeatedly assault others, including their family members. And so I was reading that, and it looks like it's in Section 2. That somebody convicted of an assault in the fourth degree is a Class C felony if the person is convicted two or more times of committing an assault. And so I'm struck by the fact that if somebody is stung by the alcohol beverage board twice, it's a Class C felony, but I get to commit assault in the fourth degree three times before it's a Class C felony. Is that, am I reading that accurately?
You are.
And what's, what, how badly can I injure Representative Dahlstrom?
What's not a, like that.
Is that a fourth degree
it
assault?
It can be.
Let's try it and see.
Oh my.
Little levity.
Oh, I'm with you. No, I'm just watching, my, watching what I'm saying. That's all. So what is a fourth degree assault about, like that?
That was probably understated, but can be pretty doggone close.
Well, fourth degree assault, where we're looking, that would be covered under this bill, would be to cause physical injury, to intentionally cause physical injury to another person, or to recklessly cause physical injury to the dangerous instrument. So physical injury means any causing any pain or impairment of health, or actually impairment of bodily conditions.
So presently, how many times can I do it and it's still a Class A misdemeanor?
An infinite number of times.
But if I made a mistake serving somebody twice in 10 years, it's a Class C felony.
Well, I don't think we've got it that high yet.
Oh, it is.
It's within the second, and this was passed in 1994, quite a while ago before my time. But it is within 5 years, so the look back period is shorter. But you are correct; it is
interesting.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, sir.
And I guess I'll come at it from a little different angle, because of the litigation world that we live in today, if people have a disagreement in a store and it ends up in pushing and shoving, that could be a fourth degree assault. If there are a range of issues that can happen that I don't think rise to the felony level, because once you hit that felony level, there's no turning back.
Your life is
saved. I agree. So I understand that there are some times where fourth degree assault absolutely should be there. But there are a lot of times that I think it's who can get to the lawyer first that creates that fourth degree assault situation. Now, they exclude the fear provision from here. And it's kind of interesting because we're in a kind of a sexual assault task force right now as we speak. And fear is sometimes more dominant than the actual physical activity. So I struggle with that, because I've seen intimidation that drives people to suicide and never a hand was laid on them. And so I just struggle with that.
That YouTube girl that a couple of months ago that was that case, it's a fascinating case that's still pending on MySpace, that the mother was aware of the phantom person that accused her of.
Yeah.
What is the purpose of 323? Is this a cleanup bill? Is this kind of a bucket of unfinished business? I mean, it's a disparate group of legislation. What's the point of this bill? And because I think it was referenced in the governor's State of the State, so I assumed before we saw this crime package come that these were going to be. It's going to be a material piece of legislation, but it looks like a hodgepodge, a piece of legislation, elements of which come dangerously close to encroaching on personal liberties of people. That's the end of my question. I had more, but I'm...
Mr. Chairman, I don't know whether you listened in, but I did attend most of the Crime Summit in the other body.
Yes, I did listen.
And the recommendations by most of the experts were our statutes are, our laws are good, but there are small changes that can be made that will make big differences or significant differences in public safety and the enforcement of law in our state. Mm-hmm. And this is a bill that includes many of those. Many of those, not necessarily small, but not necessarily related to a theme except for making public safety in our state better. And As Mr. Sobotny said when he introduced the bill, there are three areas: substantive law, procedural law, and sentencing. And there are pieces of that in this bill, each of which address a problem. We have testimony online from Mr. Steve West in Ketchikan that might illuminate the situation that we're faced with when dealing with people who are found to be incompetent. That might help you.
Okay.
Understand that.
Okay, Mr. West, have you been listening in?
I have been.
Thank you. Thank you for being so patient. I wish we would have introduced you before. We got just sidetracked by our friends here in the room. Would you go ahead and introduce yourself and then offer whatever relevant testimony that you have and then be available for questions, please?
Correct. My name's Steve West. I'm the district attorney in Ketchikan. I've been in here for about 22 years now. The ones that I'm dealing with are Section 8, 9, 10, and 19 and 20 of the bill dealing with persons found incompetent to stand trial. It sort of arose out of a case that I had involving an defendant named Marcus Anderson. What I'm telling you is all a matter of public record in his criminal cases, so it's not like anything confidential. But in 2004, he was indicted for five counts of arson in the first degree. He burnt five different buildings in 2003 to 2004. Three of them were residences. Two of the residences were totally destroyed. And he admitted to burning those four of them after he was taken into custody. The last, though, the fifth one, though, that was an individual who was witnessed the one of the houses that were burnt. It was right across the street from it, so he saw it. It was burning, and he saw Marcus Anderson coming down. And he told the police, and then 2 weeks later, for some reason, he was up at 3:30 in the morning watching TV, and he heard noise underneath his house and looked out, and he sits up on a hillside, so he could. There's stairs that go down to it, and he saw Marcus Anderson walking from his house. So he went down to see what was going on, and underneath the house, he found some ropes had been set up there, and they were set on fire. And so he had intentionally set the fire. So he had to put him out. The only thing he had to put him out with was his hands, and so he smothered him with his hands. So he burned his hands. So he's been charged with. He was charged in 2004 with five charges of arson in the first degree and one charge of assault in the third degree. However, he was eventually adjudged to be incompetent. He was sent up to Anchorage, and the psychiatrist at API determined that he was incompetent to proceed, although, strangely enough, he found that if he was competent, that there was no temporary insanity. He wasn't insane. He knew what he was doing was wrong and stuff, but that he wasn't competent because he didn't understand what the role is of a judge the jury and things like that, so... was found incompetent, and he was, the case was being dismissed, so I contacted API and talked about having a civil commitment done on him, and API went and contacted him because he was still up at the Anchorage jail, and they decided that he wasn't incompetent wasn't committable because he wasn't an immediate danger because he agreed that he would never start any more fires, and so they said, well, we can't commit him because he's not an immediate danger, So the criminal case was dismissed on March 20th, 2006, and he was released. Well, then July 21st, 2006, another residence building in Saxman was burnt down. Mr. Anderson was at the scene there, and he's been charged with arson in the first degree. That was July of 2006, so he's only been out for 4 months. And again, the defense raised that he was incompetent. He was sent up to Anchorage, and the API did an evaluation. Initially, they determined he was incompetent, but they said... was a different psychologist or psychiatrist said, well, let's see if we can make him competent, see if we can educate him on what the role is of the judge and defense attorney and everything, and see if he can understand it. And they did it, and then they found that, and they decided that he was competent and that he was able to do it. And so we're now proceeding with the 2006 arson, and I was going to re-indict him on the 2004 ones. The defense, however, has hired an expert and brought him to Ketchikan, and they're in the process, actually, as we're speaking right now, of having Mr. Anderson examined again, and they're going to try to, if they can get the experts to say he's incompetent, to reopen it and have him declared incompetent. And so if they bring the expert in and the judge makes the determination that the defense has proven he's incompetent, then and that it's going to stay that way, then the charges will again dismissed, and I have no doubt that API will do exactly what they did last time and say, well, Mr. Anderson is probably going to agree that he won't commit any more fires and he's going to be released. Mr. Anderson has he's admitted that he set at least four of the fires. We have the one in 2006, the last one in 2006, the person saw him walking away from his house and went down there and immediately found his house was on fire. And so it's clear that he's extremely dangerous, and yet under the existing law, he can't be committed because he agrees that he won't set any more fires, and therefore he won't be committed. I think under this statute, he's gone into court, and with a defense attorney, he's proven himself to be having a mental disease and mentally incompetent, and the charges being filed on felony charges, we have to take it to grand jury, which requires at least probable cause to show it. So there's at least probable cause to believe that he's a harm to others. It's not like we're bringing somebody in and we're attempting to bring somebody in who's competent and trying to get him into API. The defendant's already proven in court that it's more likely than not that he's mentally incompetent. The defense has already proven that, and what this does is just establish a mandatory presumption that he's incompetent and is a danger, and therefore needs to be civilly committed unless he can prove either that he's not a danger or that he's no longer mentally incompetent. I think that would take care of problems like this, where individuals who are found incompetent proceed with criminal trials are then deemed. API says, well, we can't commit him civilly because he agrees not to do the criminal behavior that he has, and therefore they release him, and then they go back out and do the criminal behavior. Basically, these people have no consequences. There's no way to protect against them because they're being able to commit these crimes. So I think that these provisions should be enacted so that this problem doesn't arise.
Representative Samuels has a question.
Thank you, and for anybody... just in real broad strokes, how's the competency determined? Is it a judge listening to the psychiatrists on the defense and the psychiatrists for the prosecution? Or
correct. It's the law provides that in a criminal case, a defendant is presumed competent, and so it's the person who wants to hold the defendant incompetent, which is always the defendant, has to prove that they're incompetent to be able to be found incompetent. So the defendant's has that burden of proof. They usually present psychiatrists or psychologists, and the state can present psychologists or psychiatrists who examine the defendants to testify that he is competent, and then the judge makes that determination.
Representative Dahlstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess this is more of a comment. It's interesting and disturbing at the same time, some of the things we learned going through this committee. It's amazing to me that someone is competent enough to think of a action / crime, to plan it out, to buy the materials that they need, to know that it's not acceptable behavior so they need to do it in the dark of night or hiding when no one's watching them, and to run so that they won't be caught. They're competent enough to think all of that through. And yet they're not competent to be held responsible for their actions. And to me, it's almost more, and I'm not a psychiatrist, but it's almost more psychopathic behavior, someone who has no conscience. They're perfectly competent in knowing what they're doing and knowing that it may not even be socially acceptable behavior, but it doesn't bother them in any way, shape, or form because they get some sort of gratification out of it, whether it's power, whether it's, you know, whatever it is that they get out of it. But the other thing that I think would be interesting to know, and it'd probably take years to run a study on it, just like this gentleman that Mr. West was talking about, all these years have gone by where he's in and out of API and being tried and everything. Is he working a regular job? Are we supporting him in the public welfare system and he's able to enjoy a nice lifestyle? Why? We're trying to look out for the safety of all of his neighbors and the innocent people that live around him. I mean, I know you can't give me an answer to that, but I just have a funny feeling that there's a lot of that going on, and it's just, it's not right, but it goes back to the, you know, the competency thing. How can you plan, prepare, know it's not right, so you do it in the dark, you run, you this and that, but you're not able to answer for yourself.
That's why they're changing it.
It's just amazing. So Chair Ramirez has just left us. His vote was needed in another committee. Mr. West, are there any closing remarks or anything that you would like to leave with us? Are you able to hear, Mr. West?
Sorry, I couldn't hear you.
Are there any closing remarks that you would like to leave with us?
Not really. I just think that the amendments dealing with the issue of a person being found incompetent should be enacted so that this problem doesn't occur, because I'm afraid that if he gets found incompetent and is released again, that more fires are going to be set and somebody's going to get killed, and I want to avoid that. I mean, in a situation, he would be kept locked up, and in fact, the psychiatrist who said he was incompetent in 2004 said that this individual needs to be kept in a place where he's under 24-hour supervision because he is dangerous, but there was no way to do that under when we tried to do it beforehand. But that's all I have to ask, Your Honor. Okay.
With current law, correct?
Correct.
Okay. Also online, we have Quinlan Steiner, who's been available for questions. Quinlan, do you have any comments that you wish to add to this? We have about 4 minutes left in this committee, and we are going to hold the bill. We won't be moving it today, so we'll have ample opportunity to study and come back a little bit better prepared and, you know, ready to go. But Quinlan, do you have anything you wish to put on record today?
Well, I don't have a position on the bill, but I'd be happy to come back and answer any questions you have.
Okay. And I would request that you, you probably already have, read the bill, and you will probably be asked what your position is. Also online, Josh Fink with OPA. And Josh, I have you here as willing to answer questions. Is that correct?
Madam Chairwoman, that is correct.
Okay. Are there any questions for Josh? Not today, but there will be in the future. Is there anything you wish to have on the record today, Josh?
Madam Chairwoman, I don't, like Mr. Steiner, I don't have a position on the bill. I do have some concerns with the commitment provisions I need to take a closer look at. And if there's further testimony, I may be better prepared at the next hearing.
Okay. I can guarantee you there will be further testimony on this, and I think everyone in the table, around the table and in the room, knows we have some problems. We all want to do the right thing. It's just going about it the correct way so that we can take what's existing and make it better, and make our community and our state a safer place to live. So with that, thank you everyone that testified and for the good questions. And we will go ahead and hold House Bill 323. And this meeting is dismissed at 2 minutes to 3. Thank you.